There's many aspects to my friend Charles Lipson's career and life. He's a wit. He's a literary man. He's a man of letters. He's professor emeritus of the University of Chicago, the Peter B. Ritzma Chair. He's also a writer and thinker of deep thoughts that are important to think, like how do we save the republic? How can we save the republic as our political leaders produce, I don't know, idiocy? This is the best way to say it. Because, why is he like this? Because he's a teacher. Because at bottom, Charles Lipson is a teacher. He likes to teach young people. And I never had him as a teacher, but he's a friend of mine, and I just imagine what he'd have been like. And these sessions that we have together with him on the Chicago Way, it reminds me of what it was like when you could talk to your professors and differ with them and discuss things with them. We are on the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.
So this is a guy who lives high on the hog, and he has this Tammany Hall style attitude to power. And it's the Chicago Way, absolutely.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago Way.
The Chicago Way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun, he sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
I've got two questions. These come from my wife. First, what about Trump, and will Chicago survive Brandon Johnson? And I'm wondering, I don't think Chicago will survive Brandon Johnson. And as far as Trump's concerned, well, we have Charles Lipson, professor emeritus from the Peter B. Ritzma Chair at the University of Chicago, to talk about all things cultural. But I just don't see it happening. I see Trump being swept in some sort of social media vacuum that he even can't swim against, forced to run a campaign at the behest of the Democrats because they don't want to face Ron DeSantis. That's my view. What are your views, gentlemen? Can Chicago survive? I don't think so. And can Trump avoid being sucked into the maelstrom? Hello?
Welcome.
Well, let's go to Charles, because you're the guest, Charles. And I'm John Cass. Jeff Carlin, my friend and co-host, is with us all, as always. This is the Chicago Way podcast. But friend Charles Lipson, is Trump capable of avoiding the maelstrom that the Democrats have set up for him, to suck him in to running against Ron DeSantis and thereby tubing the Republican ticket? What say you, Charles Lipson?
Trump doesn't want to avoid that maelstrom. That's what he hopes will help sweep him to victory in the Republican primary. He seems to have about 35, perhaps a little more, percentage of the Republican primary vote, but unless the other candidates consolidate, or there is what's called ranked choice voting, which is the same as an instant runoff, Trump could easily win. I do not think he can win a general election, even against an opponent as weak as Biden, because I just don't think educated, higher income, suburban voters, a lot of women voters, I just don't think any of them are going to vote for Trump. I think a lot of people were deeply troubled by his behavior after the 2020 election, which has never really stopped. And I think that he's running on a platform of revenge and payback. And we know from a lot of studies that what voters want is forward-looking solutions to problems that they know they're facing.
Well, you know, I guess I better pour a drink and just wait, because
Well, that's always a good solution, John. That's always.
Yeah, I think because I just don't see, Bushites or all the Nikki Haley's and all the others trying to get wanting to give up, because they see Trump in here. Maybe it'll give them a leg up and give them an advantage. I just see chaos. You know, chaos is Trump's bird. It shows up wherever he goes. But I don't know, Jeff. Jeff, what do you say?
I mean, I say it's been at least good for fundraising for him. I mean, some of the reports are Trump was making them pulling in $1.5 million a day, just putting out email blasts attached to this indictment. So it sounds like it's going to be just like you said, chaos, absolute chaos. I don't think he can. I don't know. I don't think he can win outright because the margins are so thin. But I wouldn't put anything past him because he's just, you know, he's a master manipulator when it comes to language and getting people riled up.
It used to be said that you had to raise money from big donors. But Trump has been pretty successful in raising it from small donors. And that's important because that means that it's not a situation where 10 people can sit down in a room or on a Zoom call and say, we don't think candidate X or Y can win. Why don't we all consolidate behind candidate Z? And that may drive out a candidate like Nikki Haley or Tim Scott or someone else, whoever that might be, if they can't raise money from small donors. But it will not drive out Trump. What could drive him out are far better indictments than the lousy one that Alvin Bragg just generated last week.
That's why I want him, in a way, because this indictment is so terrible that I want him to get a measure of a scalp. I want him to at least hold one scalp when he goes down. I want him to scream and hold one scalp, because Bragg has to pay, and the people that put Bragg in office, George Soros, has to pay. And now that's becoming quite the thing, you know, where everyone's screaming anti-Semitism left and right.
Well, we're attacked for that, John. Wrongly attacked for that when you were among the first people to really call out the malevolent activity that George Soros was conducting around the country. And what we've seen is time after time after time, these prosecutors have just created very unsafe conditions for their cities.
And there's no payment. They don't have to pay. I mean, the guy in San Francisco, I guess he was removed, right? Wasn't he?
Right.
The one who was raised by wolves. Raised by wolves in Hyde Park, right near the University of Chicago.
Right.
Tom Ayers, right? And Tom Ayers' grandson, yeah.
And those guys were a machine. You know, Tom Ayers, one of the things that really helped them was that Tom Ayers, who headed the state's big electrical system, was very close to the elder Mayor Daley. But that's all inside politics. But I've got to say that the situation with rogue prosecutors is really terrible. We've had it in city after city. We have it in Chicago's county, Cook County, with Kim Fox. They have it in St. Louis. They have it in L.A. They had to replace the guy in San Francisco. It's city after city. Philadelphia has a particularly bad one, Larry Krasner. So there, it's not a one size fits all. It's one size misfits everything.
Jeez, does it, Charles? Speak to that a little. What did you find so appalling in the Bragg situation and the case that was brought against Trump? I mean, from a legal perspective, what do you see there?
Well, I'm not a lawyer, and I don't play one on podcasts, but there are several things. Basically, the first thing is everything starts with Bragg saying that Trump mislabeled his pay. It's not illegal to make a payment to a porn star. We've all done it.
There's a form for it, I'm sure.
He made it from the Trump Organization, which he wholly owns. So he didn't put it on the books of some public company and misrepresent it. Even if it had been a misrepresentation, the statute of limitations has run on it. It's a misdemeanor. Bragg wants to escalate it all to a felony. How does he do that? He does it by trying to connect it to another crime. Mm-hmm. What's the other crime? He won't tell us. He won't tell us what's the other crime. It's behind door number three, right, or maybe door number two.
That's the best part. He describes it. He's like, well, it's bigger than a bread box, has a little frill on it. Like, you might recognize it in some states, known as, like, it's just, he tag danced around it in such a beautiful way. And you're like, oh, just say it.
Yeah. So that's the beginning of the problem. But it doesn't end there. He ginned it up before a sort of handpicked grand jury. All of them are. The classic statement is you could indict a ham sandwich. The fact is, a ham sandwich was probably more guilty in this case. And I'm not a Trump fan. The fact is, it's really a miscarriage of justice, by this man who was elected just like Kim Fox, just like Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, just like Chesa Boardman in San Francisco and all the rest, the guy in LA who's just as bad. They've all been elected. Now the governor of New York could remove Bragg, but there's not a chance that she will, in not only because she probably agrees with him, but because it's impossible for a Democratic elected official to take a controversial action against an African-American politician, since Democrats can't win without a strong turnout and uniform vote by African-Americans who vote Democratic in overwhelming numbers. So they're kind of in a box there. But I want to say one more thing, which I think is the worst part of Bragg's indictment. The whole system of justice depends upon beginning with a crime and then finding out who perpetrated it and whether they should be charged. It never is supposed to begin with a person and then look to find a crime. And that's
who is that fellow?
Hmm?
Who is that fellow who said, I have found you the man, and this is the crime?
It was Stalin. It was Stalin, or maybe it was Beria, the head of his secret Beria. Police. That's the way that those systems work. They could point to Jeff, they could point to John, they could point to Charles, and then start looking for any kind of crime that we might have committed. The whole system is not supposed to work that way.
But when liberal Democrats who in my lifetime prided themselves on tolerance and justice and social justice, when they begin to act like Beria and say, I've given you this is the man, now we'll find the crime. I need to find the crime because to fit the man, What happened?
We're not just saying that. Bragg ran on that campaign, and so did the Attorney General of New York State, Letitia James. They ran on that platform. We will get Trump.
Yeah, and Charles, suppose any of this prosecution goes through, how does this play out in a sense in the actual election? I mean, what happens? How does a president run, you know, have to be in court and then be campaigning and not talk about either one? I mean,
I think it's a big problem in multiple ways, and not just for Trump, certainly not just for this indictment. I think that the this thing could be thrown out at some point along the way. Sure. It is likely to be if there's a serious review by higher courts. But I think that he's got real legal jeopardy in Florida. He's got real legal jeopardy in Georgia. I think that the strongest and, in a way, the easiest case is not that he had the documents in Mar-a-Lago, but that he'd formally declared that he had returned all of those documents. And he had not. That's what the FBI search of Mar-a-Lago revealed. They turned up all these documents, and he said he had returned them all. The formal charge for that is obstruction of justice. And that's kind of the meat and potatoes prosecution for the Department of Justice. But it's a shame to see so much of our elections tied up in these legal matters. But let me tell you, Joe Biden is not home free either, because there should have been a special prosecutor for Hunter. There has not been, but they have left the old prosecutor in place in Delaware, who was appointed by Donald Trump. And we need to hear one way or another whether there's going to be an indictment. The indictment of the son would not normally involve the father or the cousins or the brothers and the uncles or whatever. But in this case, it does, because it was a family enterprise. They were all, at the very least, we know that they were trading on Joe Biden's name and his public office. That's not illegal, but it could be that they've turned up some elements of Joe Biden participating in that. As far as I know, he's not been called before a grand jury, but there have been allegations that he was a direct partner in a number of these enterprises. And if they don't ask for his testimony in that case, they should at least get very clear testimony one way or the other about his participation. So we're going to have legal issues hanging over this whole campaign.
Wow. A ripe time for history. Jeez.
We've never had in our country, we've had similar problems, but not problems quite like these. And when you have the institutions in peril and the public's understanding of right and wrong of things in peril, and the Department of Justice being treated like a political football. I remember under Nixon when it was considered the worst thing in the world, and now it's just part of the game. What happens to the Republic? Because that's my greatest concern. Not Trump, not Biden, not Biden's politics, not Hunter's ridiculous art projects. And he can sell $500,000 worth of finger paints to Chinese operatives, and everyone's happy. But what about our republic?
I think that that's the important message. I've just been writing about this kind of tit for tat that's going on with the Bragg indictment, which we just talked about, and the Tennessee legislature booting out some representatives who clearly violated all the rules. You can't go into the well of the House with a bullhorn and just obstruct all business. But the question is whether the punishment was adequate. Since then, we've had a jury, a sort of forum shopping, it's called, where somebody who wanted to make illegal the over-the-counter, that what's so-called day-after pill for terminating pregnancies, found one judge who was willing to overturn a pill that had been on the market for something like two decades. And since then, we've had representatives, elected representatives, saying this should just be ignored. It's a bad decision, in my opinion, but it should never be ignored. This is a legal decision by a federal judge. It needs to be overturned by an appellate court. And that can be done quickly and should be done quickly, in my opinion. But what you're seeing here is a kind of body blow after body blow to the republic we love. I wrote a piece that focused on Tennessee and Bragg because this story about the day after pill hadn't come out yet. And I end by saying that the deeper message is that preserving our democracy requires prudence, good judgment, and some self-restraint by elected leaders and judges. Those qualities are endangered. They're being killed by the bitter politics of payback and revenge. They're all cloaked in self-righteous contempt for all of our opponents. And I conclude by saying the tide of vitriol is rising. That's another swamp that needs draining.
Nerve-wracking. I mean, my wife and I just came back from a little road trip to the central part of Illinois, and we had conversations similar to this, just in discussion about what we were seeing and what we were experiencing along the way. I don't know. We're going to see it in a microcosm here in Chicago with the election of Brandon Johnson, I feel like, because here's somebody who I feel like is going to have, like they have, you know, an open check to do whatever they want to change, alter the future of the city or change the way the city is run currently, even though an abysmal amount of number of people voted and it was a very small turnout from that. It's going to be really crazy to see what happens here as our prosecutors continue their path. What do you see, Charles, in the next 4 years, the big decisions that might be had to made by the next administration under Johnson?
I just think that Johnson will test the limits of what you can do to a city and have that city survive. I think the first question, and John would have a much better sense of this than I do, is whether Brandon Johnson will have control of the city council. What he wants to do is jack up taxes in a massive way. We know what will happen when you do that. People will leave the city. New businesses won't start. People won't hire other people. We already know that that's happened in New York, in Connecticut, in California. And you can do it in the short run, but you pay a very heavy price. We know that he not only doesn't want to hire more police, but the police who are already there won't feel like they have any political backing when they really need it. And why should they get out of their car? Why should they get out of their car?
I tell them all the time, never don't get out of their car, especially the young ones.
Yeah.
Stay in your car. Yeah. I'll tell your father. I said,
Yeah. I mean, I see, and then we know that he'll do a giveaway contract to the teachers union, because virtually all, and I don't mean sort of 35 or 40%, I mean over 95% of his donations came from the teachers union and other affiliated unions, far left progressive unions. So he's going to give the teachers the contract they want, and he's going to try to prevent any charter schools and close down what's there. I see when I talk to friends who are progressive, I ask them a question that I haven't heard a good answer, which is, can you name a well-governed progressive city, a city that has a very progressive mayor and the like that's doing a really good job. I can think of a couple that are growing very rapidly. Austin, Texas is one example, and it's quite liberal, and you might say that it's doing fine, but there are not many. And my own sense is that this kind of politics, first of all, Brandon Johnson won in part because Paul Vallis was a very weak opponent. He had a great resume, but when you looked at each job, he hadn't accomplished a lot, and you could see his ineffectiveness as an administrator by the kind of campaign he ran.
Well, he was hobbled because he had the big disadvantage. He was white.
Which is, well, that,
and yeah, that translated in the political text. That translated, if you were white, that translated into you're DeSantis or Trump Republican, you're MAGA, you're therefore suspect, you're morally suspect. And the media played along with this and reinforced these themes. Mm. And Mr. Johnson benefited. And so what did he benefit?
I do think that racial mobilization politics helped him. But I think, for example, after he was the leading candidate in the first election, he should have immediately built on that, gone on the air, worked hard. He didn't do that. He didn't have a good ground game. Of course, the ground game of Brandon Johnson was really union workers.
Teachers union, right.
Yeah, teachers BTU. Union. And I got to tell you, on the South Side, those posters were everywhere, just everywhere. And you could just tell that he had a lot of organized backing. But I think the question is now, can he govern the city? And the answer is Lori Lightfoot couldn't, and I have no reason to think that this guy can.
Lori Lightfoot had a lot more experience in life than Brandon Johnson has, and she couldn't handle it. She caved to Tony Preckwinkle and Kim Fox. And now we have Brandon Johnson, who's there to protect Tony Preckwinkle and Kim Fox. He will not call them to account for the politics of permissiveness and the lack of prosecutions. He's not going to do it.
What do you think, and Jeff too, what do you think turns this around in cities like Chicago?
I think that we go through a period of at least two generations of complete cratering. And then slowly it begins to change, if it ever does. Otherwise, it becomes worse than Detroit ever was. I mean, that's what you have to deal with. And unfortunately, the media, which cratered to George Soros and his buddies in the issues that involved me in Chicago, will crater again. And it's not good. It's not pretty for the city of Chicago. Look, we're going to have violent crime. I'm working on something too. The temperature's rising. As the temperature rises, the violent crime increases. The bodies hit the floor. The mothers cry. They build their makeshift shrines about the dead youths. And it won't stop. It won't stop because there won't be prosecutors to do the job. Nobody wants to be called a racist. White media people don't want to be called racist, MAGA, Republicans, how dare you? And they've ceded the field to WBEZ, to the Tribune Guild, to all the lefties who tell stories about themselves. And one story they don't want to tell is that they're tough on crime.
Well, that's right. And I think that the only way that turns around is when you have a black middle class that says, right, we've had enough. Our neighborhoods are dangerous and our schools are so lousy that we need some place to send our kids. And it's sorting out at the national level as people move. They're leaving these progressive states and they're going elsewhere. And you can see it in downtown Detroit. People tell me you can see it in downtown Manhattan and so forth, where stores are now vacant. Part of that is Amazon, but they just haven't come back and by the way, there's no guarantee that this won't get worse with a recession.
Yes.
Which could be on the horizon. There's no guarantee. Yeah. No one knows. This recession has been like the horizon. It keeps receding into the future. But if there
I'm
is.
I'm trying to get depressed. I'm getting so depressed I might have to move to Northwest Indiana. Oh, I did.
I do think that we're facing one other thing that I think sort of is an overarching issue in our polity, and that is it's become much more ideological. It's become ideological, and as it has become ideological, people see their political opponents not as the loyal opposition, but as contemptible.
Mm-hmm.
And you just can't run a democracy without that kind of tolerance. And that really began on university campuses. They shut down speech. Why do you shut down speech? Because that speech does not deserve to be heard. Not the traditional liberal view, which is that you just debate that person. But we see it on campus after campus. What do you see the university administrators doing? They cave. Why do they cave? Because they're administrators, and where's the risk to them? The risk to them is that if they act in a serious way, they'll be booted out. Their job is much more at risk. And we're going to see a test of this at Stanford, right? Stanford shut down a federal judge. And the students in the law school shut down a federal judge. And then participating in that was a university administrator who should have been a voice of reason as a sort of an adult in the room. Mind you, the students in the room are as old as the Marquis de Lafayette and so forth when he was George Washington's assistant in the war. These are not children. They're full adults. But the university administrator came in there and basically said that the students were right and that a federal judge should understand their position. She's on leave of some sort. Well, I don't know whether it's paid or not, but the dean is now trying to say, well, this was a bad thing and it should never have happened. But none of the students have been punished. None of the students have their names. I suggested that their names be disclosed to all law firms that would seek to hire them, that this is a person who shut down the speech of a federal judge.
Wow.
But nothing has happened to those students. And let me tell you, when nothing happens, when you walk into Walgreens and start stealing everything and nothing happens to you, you're going to walk into a CVS and do it.
Well, there's one other advantage to having Charles Lipson here with us, and that is what he just said. The kind of thing that he just posed, the problems facing the Republic that he just offered us to examine. And I have another that I'd like Charles to consider. And you, Jeff, too. We asked early on, or just a few minutes ago, in terms of crime and the epidemic of crime and the reluctance of the Cook County Democrats to pursue crime and pursue challenges to crime. I keep thinking, and you say, what will change? Is there anything that will change? I keep thinking that when the Republic, as you said, when the black middle class has no more Atlantis to send their kids, and they can't go anywhere, they get mad. Someday, among them, will come another Malcolm X, and that's the only saving thing that could happen. It would be terrible, and it would be difficult, and there would be people hurt on all sides for a revolutionary figure like that to emerge. But I think somebody like Malcolm X is needed. And the times, the history keeps spitting out people that we need at the time we need it. And do you see a possibility there, Charles, or do you think that it's really a danger to even think that way?
Well, I think there's a possibility, and I think it's dangerous. That is, I think that the problem with these kind of mass movements is that there are no boundaries to them. We saw that time and time again with populist movements. In the South, those populist movements began in the 1890s or so by trying to organize both the blacks and white poor farmers in a biracial coalition. When that failed to win, the people who led that, and the key person was a guy named Tom Watson, they became really rabid racist to mobilize their population. And that's a tradition that went all the way through to George Wallace, right? We see racial mobilization politics in the last election in Chicago. But we also see it on college campuses. We see, and John, you and I have talked a lot about this. Jeff, you've been part of these discussions, but they've been very important in John's life because the issue of him being a Greek American, me being a Jewish American, and so forth. The question is, how do those ethnic markers or religious markers relate to our sense that we're 100% American? Not to depreciate those. I mean, you know, John is a Greek American and he's proud of his heritage. When my father died and some years ago, and I had to talk to a visiting rabbi because our little synagogue had shut down. There weren't enough people left in rural Mississippi. And I said, you have to understand, my dad was 100% Jewish and proud of being Jewish, but he was 100% American and proud of being an American. And he saw no contradiction between the two. The most important picture I ever saw that my dad took was a picture of the bottom of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I said, why'd you take it, Dad? He said, because I was on a troop ship going out to fight in the Pacific in World War II, and I never knew if I would see America again. And that was the last thing I saw was the bottom of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I remember that. And I think that we've lost something in our universities and so forth. It's nothing wrong at all with teaching people to be proud that they're African American or Greek American or Jewish American or whatever. But it has to be in the overall context that we're a United States of America.
And sometimes I wonder if I don't wonder. I think how we've let our fathers and grandfathers down with all this, the talk of politics and the exclusivity where you're a person of this party, you can't be American, you can't be or you're Jewish and you shouldn't be Jewish, or Greek and you shouldn't be Greek. And our fathers who believed 100% of their bodies and souls and put their lives on the line to prove it in the wars,
right.
That there was no difference, that you could be 100% American and 100% of your ethnic marker.
I think we let them down.
Now I think we have to let
a younger generation know that you can be a Republican and 100% American and not contemptible to somebody who is in your dorm and is a Democrat and is also 100% American. But as soon as those people start thinking that the country itself is contemptible.
But when the president of the United States goes on and on to equate contemptibility with membership in a political party like MAGA and hysteria, MAGA hysteria.
Look at the way that it's contemptible. Now that I've been yelling at other people for saying it, I think that sort of thing is beneath the office. But I also think that the way that Donald Trump goes and attacks the family members by name of judges other, I think that it's a reasonable thing to raise as a question about whether or not these people have bias. But when you start telling a national crowd, a televised national crowd, that bad things about the family members of public officials, something bad could easily happen. And I just find it... we've gone off the rails here, and it's important to begin by recognizing that and then trying to say which kind of core values we need to reestablish to get back on the rails rather than have all this toxic waste flowing into our streams.
Civility is an important thing, and I hope we can someday come to grips with at least talking about it. Talking about civility, where we don't talk about people shaking their ass, and instead talk about what the virtues are that they're seeking.
John,
maybe someday
Jeff,
we'll do
you're
that.
Jeff, you're younger than us. You're not a mere Ute. I know that, but
he knows what shake your ass is.
I know you constantly shake your ass. But when you all talk about this, do you share the same sense of concern?
Definitely.
The Republic?
Yeah. Just about people in general being civil anywhere we go, doing anything, it feels like it's a lost art and it's not a part of culture anymore. And it's unnerving to say
the least. Do you think has caused it?
I think it's the idea that people have an opinion and therefore that opinion is important, that all opinions are important because everything is on social media and what it gets liked or finds other people who have similar, views or what have you. I think we just have lost the ability to not have our opinion really mean as much as it should. Or be as valid or as useful as that other opinion, I don't know. I think people feel like if they have an opinion about you, even if it's mean or negative, they have the right to share it and or the obligation to share it for some reason. And even in person, I feel like people are less polite. So I don't know.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I think, the fragmentation of the media has made, things worse. Everybody wants to see their own opinion confirmed. So we tune in to, podcasts and we tune into cable channels and all the rest to see our views reinforced rather than contested. what I think is really troubling is that our education systems ought to be pushing back against that. That's a place where we ought to value free speech and the fact that free speech has declined on college campuses. It has been a particular concern to me.
Charles Lipson, that's why you are a teacher. Above all yes. things, a teacher. And mm-hmm. I want to thank you once again for being here on the Chicago Way with Jeff Carlin and I, and trying to put this into some sort of context. Brandon Johnson and Donald Trump, the two big mouths, who maybe expect to be treated differently than they treat others. I don't know if it'll happen. Thanks for joining us, sir. Thanks again.
It is my pleasure. I always enjoy getting together with you, John, and I'm glad you're back in the saddle, my friend.
Well, thanks to you and people like you, I can climb up out of this wheelchair and grab that shillelagh and swing it occasionally. Now that I have a shillelagh, I'm the envy of Jeff Carlin. He Absolutely. Saw the shillelagh and he's like, oh man, how did you get a real shillelagh? My brother.
Well,
Nick.
I want to see you back. I want to see you back dancing on the dance floor. Good to talk to both of you.
All right,
it's
buddy.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charles.
Thank you, Charles. For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, University of Chicago, great thinker, writer, for many, many publications, Real Clear Politics, American Greatness, on and on. And for Jeff Carlin, executive producer, WGN Radio, master of pies, friend to cats. And for me, John Cass, executive producer. I'm sorry, getting my titles confused. John Cass, executive editor of JohnCassNews.com, your favorite site for Midwestern common sense. And join us again next week, won't you, for another edition of the Chicago Way podcast on WGN Plus.